Psalm 14, I want to ask a question to start with, though. And that question is, what has been the biggest change that you have seen in the world in your lifetime? So what's been the biggest change that you've seen in the world in your lifetime? 2 seconds to think about it. Then have a little chat to the person next to you. And by that time, we'll have sorted out my stuff. We'll come back to Psalm 14. Okay, well, time up. I don't know what you came up with, but I thought it would be good to get started with that, as I wanted you to think through for yourselves just how rapidly and radically the world changes. Depending on how old you are, you'll no doubt have come up with a variety of answers. But for me, I thought of 3 main areas where things have changed beyond all recognition in my lifetime. Maybe interesting to see whether these were what you came up with as well. So the first one, technology. See a few nods there. My first ever job was at the Prudential down in Hoban, a couple of miles away. And there was actually something called a computer when I was there, but it was huge. And you used to have to request a report, which would take at least a week or so to get back. So the thought of PCs, smartphones, iPads, the internet and so on would, I think, have completely blown our minds back then in the late 70s. So I guess if you had to go for one thing that's changed society most in the last 50 years or so, this would probably have to be it. But there were 2 other major areas that I came up with as well. The second one is the explosion of travel. My first ever flight, I think it was a BUA flight, which dates me. Definitely went from Gatwick to Jersey when I was 6 years old. I remember that. But I was actually 15 before I took my first flight abroad. And yet by the time they were both 2, my son had gone to Canada and my youngest daughter had gone to Sri Lanka. So I guess massive changes again in this time, 20 to 30 years. There, the gap we're talking about. And then the third one, the shifts that we've seen in world politics. So when I was growing up, the Berlin Wall was this massive no-entry symbol, marking the dividing line between who we saw as the goodies on the west side of the line and the baddies on the other side of the barbed wire. And you couldn't even start to imagine what it was like to live on the other side of that wall. And yet last month I was at a conference of, there were about 700 Christians there from all over Europe, east and west, staying in a hotel in the south of Poland, which had originally been built for the benefit of the Communist Party. And it was quite moving really to be there and sense how history had moved on, that 700 Christians could meet in this same place. So whichever way you look at it, we live in a world of constant and monumental change. Sometimes things may look as though they're standing still, but the next minute you blink, you've missed something, and that's just the way the world is. And I guess this just makes it all the more of a shock when we look at the first few verses of Psalm 14, verses 1 to 4, because what we've got here is something written about 3,000 years ago, and yet it could just as easily have been written by any one of us as we stroll down Regent Street to get here today. And what it says is completely timeless, because it paints a picture of the unchanging face of human nature. What does it say? Well, we start with verse 1. The fool says in his heart, there's no God. They are corrupt. Their deeds are vile. There is no one who does good. So this isn't just describing those who call themselves atheists. It's talking about anyone who chooses to behave as though God doesn't exist. The word fool carries the connotation of somebody with no moral compass whatsoever. So this can just as easily be someone who's at church every week on a Sunday, and yet it doesn't make the blindest bit of difference to how they live their lives. And then we go on to verses 2 and 3, and we have this picture of God looking down to see if anyone is actually seeking him. And we read that all have turned away, all have become corrupt. There's no one who does good, not even one. So what we've got here is the classic crime of all humanity. We've been created by God to live in relationship with him in the world that he has made. And yet, we've turned our backs on him and said, sorry God, I'm going to do things my way. And it's a crime we're all guilty of. Some may appear worse than others, but when the jury returns, the verdict is that no one is found innocent. We all, by nature, ignore God and go our own way. And then as we head on into verse 4, the picture gets even more ugly as we're told that these evil fools devour my people as though eating bread. So it's dog eat dog. Every man or woman for themselves. We're all pawns in the game of life looking after number one. So this may have been written 3,000 years ago, but the bottom line is that not a lot has changed. The psalmist may not be able to tell you what an iPad is, but that doesn't stop him giving a witheringly accurate analysis of what life looks like if you scratch under the surface of any West End office today. And if, as you read these verses, you think they sound a bit familiar, keep your finger in Psalm 14 and turn forward to the New Testament, to Romans chapter 3, which is page 1130. I'm going to be dotting backwards and forwards a little bit between these two passages. They're worth making sure you keep a finger in both as we go through. So page 1130, Romans chapter 3. So what you've got, obviously, in the book of Romans is what you've got is the Apostle Paul carefully constructing this thesis on the history of God's relationship with mankind. And as we come to chapter 3, you'll see that in verses 10 to 12, about 1,000 years after they've first been written, Paul chooses to quote almost word for word what we've just been reading in Psalm 14. So verse 10, as it is written, there is no one righteous. Not even one. There's no one who understands. There's no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good. Not even one. So the picture they paint may not be pretty, but the timelessness of these words is remarkable. In a world of constant change, there are some things that never change. Humanity in general will always turn its back on God and do its own thing. So that's the bad news. And verses 1 to 4 of Psalm 14 tell us that loud and clear. But there is also some good news. That isn't where the story ends. So if we flip back to Psalm 14, as we read on to verse 5, something happens. And there's a sudden and unexpected twist. The domineering self-confidence of the evildoers suddenly evaporates, and we're told, verse 5, that there they are, overwhelmed with dread. So there's a total transformation. Why? Well, it's not spelled out in detail, but there's just a simple explanation given. For God is present in the company of the righteous. So is this a real situation that's happening to the psalmist? Is it the recollection of something that's happened in the past, or the imagination of something that'll happen in the future, or a combination of all of those? Well, you can take your pick, because it's just not clear. But what is clear is that something radical happens. And it happens because, in spite of man's universal rebellion against God, his presence can still be seen amongst those who are counted as righteous. So, question, obviously, who are the righteous? Well, need to go back to Romans 3 again, so I hope you kept your finger in there. And let's go down a little bit more to verses 21 to 24. So verse 21, but now apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness is given through faith in Christ Jesus to all who believe. There's no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. So if you were here last week, Paul Enns took us through Psalm 8, and he was saying how the Psalms, even though they were written for their own time and context, very often will speak prophetically into the future. And what's happening is the Apostle Paul here is picking up on this very aspect as he takes Psalm 14 again and says that the only truly righteous people are very simply those who trust in Christ. And he goes on to say that they're declared righteous by God because of Jesus' sacrificial death on the cross. So whatever else Psalm 14 verse 5 is referring to, there's clearly some elements of the prophetic in it concerning the justification that Christ will bring. And if you're in any doubt about that, look forward to verse 7 of Psalm 14, where we're told, oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord restores his people, let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. So this must surely also be in some way an expression of longing for the Messiah, whatever the picture of the Messiah was at the time of writing. So I want to take a closer look at that connection between verse 5 and verse 7 in a minute. But before then, I just want to look at the connection between verse 5 and verse 6, which I've skipped over so far, as there's some huge promises there which are so crucial to hold on to as we live our Christian lives day by day. Because there's no doubt if you look at the history of the world and you do a proper survey of the Bible, that the normal experience of the believer is one of struggle. It's true that in this country and in many others in the Western world in recent years, that we've had the freedom to speak about our faith in a way that's been denied to so many of our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world. But even here, if you looked at it as being just a little bit over the top or weird, if you call yourself a committed Christian. And if we're talking about changes in the last 30 years or so, one other obvious change is that the British law and the prevailing culture in general is moving further and further away from the Christian foundations that we've had. So it shouldn't be a surprise if we find ourselves being marginalised at best or persecuted at worst as we live our daily lives. And you can see this clearly from today's passage as well. I mentioned verse 4, talking about people being devoured as if they're bread. But the bit I glossed over is that it isn't just anybody who's mentioned here. It's my people, God's people, who are the ones being eaten or devoured. And also, if you go on to verse 6, you can see that God's people pick up the label of the poor to reinforce this. And yet, the fact that God's people are under pressure isn't the primary point that's here in verses 5 and 6. The primary point is that the evildoers who are persecuting the poor end up seeing that God provides a refuge for them. And as a result, they recognise God's presence. And it's as a result of that that they're terrified as to what this means for them. A few months ago, I had the privilege of meeting somebody who works extensively in a country where there's severe persecution of Christians. And yet, in spite of this, there's currently huge numbers of people coming to faith. The first thing he said was that everybody now knew someone personally who'd turned to Christ, which was quite an amazing thing to hear. But the most fascinating thing he said was that Christians in general, in his country, are now known as the good people. Because what happens is that when someone becomes a Christian, something changes in their behaviour and everybody sees it. So what they say to people is, you don't actually have to go back and tell your family you've become a Christian. It's pretty dangerous anyway. But at the same time, you mustn't lie. So when they go back home, people notice the change in them. And eventually they say, you're much nicer than you were. Have you become a Christian? And of course, they then have to say yes. So people recognise that God is present in the company of the righteous. And he says now the authorities just, they don't know what to do about it. Because every time they stand down on it, then more people seem to get converted. And what's more, many in their own families now are becoming Christians. So it's an amazing story in its own right. But it is a wonderful illustration of verses 5 and 6 of Psalm 14, of how the world comes to recognise the presence of Christ through his people as he provides a refuge for them. But yet when we put these verses together with verse 7, you actually see an even bigger picture emerging. Because you can look at verse 7 on a sort of sliding scale, if you like, of levels as you go from past to present to future. So at the first level, verse 7 is merely an expression of the psalmist's longing for the salvation of Israel, almost certainly through the promised Messiah, as he expressed it 3,000 years ago. Then at the next level, of course, as we see things today, salvation has now come out of Zion through the incarnation and atoning death of Jesus. So to a degree, the longing of the psalmist has now been fulfilled. And yet, that's surely only partially true. A further 2,000 years have gone by since then, and still we see the fools saying, there is no God. Still God looks down to see if there are any who seek him. And still, even those of us who are counted as righteous because of Christ know the day-to-day struggles, even with our own sinful nature, let alone any persecution that we may have to face because of our faith. So although on one level Jesus has won a decisive victory, to the neutral observer, life goes on exactly as it did 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and the world in general isn't quaking in its boots in the manner that we see in verse 5. So surely there has to be a third level in which we need to look at verse 7. And it's at this third level that we see the deepest level of prophecy in this psalm. The deep longing for salvation's come didn't stop 2,000 years ago. The restoration of God's people that makes Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad will only fully be complete when Jesus comes back again. And of course, that's the rest of the story that Paul goes on to unpack when you move on from verse 3 of Romans to the rest of the book. So only then, when Jesus comes back again, will fools in verse 1 finally be shown to be precisely that. Only then will the righteous in verse 6 be clearly seen as the wise. Only then will there be fullness of joy and all wrongs will be righted. And only then will the full terror of judgment fill with dread those who've chosen to live as if God is not there. So that's the deepest level to which we can take this psalm. It looks all the way to the end of time and sees the dread which will engulf those who say there is no God as they see Jesus returning in all his glory to finally redeem his people. So where does this leave us? Well, firstly, I guess we should just stand in awe at the way the whole of the Bible holds together as a unified story. That a psalm of meaning and relevance to the writer 3,000 years ago should contain a prophetic voice that runs all the way through to the end of history. Secondly, as God's people, we should take comfort. Because whatever may be thrown at you or I, because of our faith, the evildoers' plans are frustrated and the Lord is indeed our refuge. And then finally, surely, we should want to take stock of our own lives. The most certain thing in the world is that Jesus is going to return. This is reality, whatever it may look like when we disappear from here in a few minutes and head back to where we've come from. So let's hold on to that truth as we leave here. And let's long for our lives to be transformed step by step into being those same good people through whom the love and mercy of Christ can be clearly seen.